Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and with me is co-host Jeremy Goldcorn, new daddy and the man behind Danway.com. How are you, Jeremy?
A very good evening to you, Kaiser. I'm very happy tonight.
Do you have any good news to share?
I have a new daughter, Viola Wuling Goldcorn.
Yeah! Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
We all, on behalf of all listeners, welcome to the world, Viola. And we'll try not to f*** it up before you grow
before
up.
She's old enough to see. Yeah, please.
Joining us today is Seneca regular Jeremiah Jenny, Dean of Chinese Studies at the IES program in Beijing, and doctoral candidate in Chinese history at the University of California, Davis, where he's a rising Qing scholar. He's also the blogger behind the excellent blog Jottings from the Granite Studio and part of the still newish group blog Rectified.name. Welcome back, Jeremiah. Good to see you.
Good evening, Kaiser.
So today on Seneca, the Manchu episode. So those of you who listened to This American Life last week may have heard an excerpt by Mike Meyer, author of The Last Days of Old Peking, from his forthcoming book In Manchuria. And those of you who read The Economist's excellent Analects blog may have seen something that Jeremiah contributed recently called Qing TV, It's a Good Time to Be a Manchu. And those, of course, were the inspirations for today's episode. We are going to look at the historical rise of these Tungusic tough guys, their ascent to the heights of dynastic might, their decline with the fall of the Qing dynasty, and their slide into, well, I guess you'd call it relative obscurity. Their linguistic near-death experience, and the revival of interest in Manchu ethnicity in recent years. And we're also going to take a look at how scholarship about the Manchus and the Qing dynasty more broadly has changed in recent decades with the so-called New Qing History Movement. Jeremy, Danway has a new feature called the Danway Week. I guess you'd call it sort of a Danway Seneca co-production, right?
Yeah, work in progress, where we're going to select what we think is the essential reading in English in blogs and news media about China over the last week. And we're working on it at the moment slowly together with our interns and developing it. So feedback would be welcome, either at the various Seneca feedback options or feedback at danway.com. So let me launch into this week's stories.
What do we got this week?
Quite a lot on women, actually, interestingly enough, after our Seneca Women podcast. First one is headlined Sexual Abuse of Children Left Behind by Migrant Workers on the Rise. And this is, in fact, in the Global Times English version, and it's rather distressing, but well worth reading. Second piece we have is a blog post on Ministry of Tofu, which looks at something that's been in the news for a while, obviously the forced abortion victim that we recently discussed, Feng Jiemei, her and her family being accused of being traitors by village officials, apparently, and there's been a fair bit of posting about this.
We're pretty sure that it was organized by village officials, not just by people who were indignant about him having talked to the Japanese and other foreign press.
I don't know who it was. It was organized. It's one of those stories that I think would require a little research, but it's worth noting.
Yes, absolutely.
Next one we have at the moment is Holding Up Half the Sky But Taking Half the Rap, another one that is really about women that is by Tea Leaf Nation. So it's about the sexual harassment on the Shanghai subway. The Shanghai subway's Weibo posted a photo of a woman wearing a rather, not very sexy, but rather revealing outfit and said, if you dress like this, you know, expect to be harassed, more or less. And then there was a little mini cute protest saying we should be able to dress slutty and still go on the subway, basically. But it has stirred up a bit of a debate on the Chinese internet, which is interesting.
Yeah, following a little bit of that, that's great.
Still on the topic of women, Paul French, the author of Midnight in Peking, wrote an article for Foreign Policy talking about how Gu Kailai fits into a very common theme in China of blaming everything on the woman. And one thinks of Empress Dowager Cixi, the Song
Empress
Sisters,
Wu,
Empress Wu Zetian,
yeah.
etc. The Economist also had a blog post on Analects, The Place of Young Women, probably worth a read. Finally,
that was actually you, right, Jeremiah?
Oh, was that you, Jeremiah? I didn't realize. So that was Jeremiah.
Yeah,
the mysterious JJ character. Okay, so I would say that was worth a read. And you didn't pay us before this, so there we go.
I did gesticulate wildly in my general direction.
You
like
did,
some sort
you
of
did.
Moron. So, take that for what it was.
And then finally, two other stories. I think maybe we've got too many stories this week. But anyway, there was another riot in Guangdong in which apparently migrant workers from Sichuan clashed with locals. I'm still not too clear what exactly the fallout of this riot is, but there's still obviously quite a bit of unrest in the Pearl River Delta. And finally, the State Administration of Radio, Film and Television announced a crackdown on unethical practices in the media, essentially bribing journalists. And like all such crackdowns, one can expect nothing at all to be affected. And that is the Danway Week.
Crackdown. Very good. I mean, I like that. That's cool. That's a very good summation of what's going on. So what we're going to do today before we dive into the topic, I mean, we've had, let's face it, we've had a lot of very serious podcasts recently, and I think there's call for some levity today. So I'd like to read for you a little something that I wrote about 9 years ago when I was a columnist for the magazine That's Beijing. It was before they all jumped ship and started the Beijinger, where I went along with them. So before you decide to write me any hate mail, please know that this was done completely tongue-in-cheek, and I mean no offense to anyone who may happen to be of Manchu ethnicity. This little piece is called Who Manchu, or Who Manchu? I was rifling through my wife's purse the other day when I made the startling discovery that she's a minority. There it was, right there on her ID card, after nationality. Man, not Han. Wait a minute, I thought. Fan Fan doesn't sing or dance or don colorful raiment and ornate headdresses, nor for that matter have I ever known her to celebrate Water Splashing Day. What kind of a minority nationality are these Manchus anyway? I felt a sharp pang of guilt. How little I understood this important part of her very identity, how remiss in my husbandly duties. And so, the better to appreciate her, I undertook a journey of discovery that would lead me deep into the labyrinthine hutongs of Dongcheng District, a journey in search of the Manchu people. It turns out that many people I know happen to be Manchu. Why, you may be sitting next to one right now and not even know it. The writer Lao She of Camel Shangzi and Tea House fame was Manchu. So is Cao Xueqin, who wrote Dream of Red Mansions, and Jerry Chan, who edits this magazine. Manchu people, I discovered, invariably know to which of the eight Manchu banners and their families belonged, and are singularly proud of their particular banner. The banners were hereditary military administrative divisions identified by four colors in plain and bordered varieties. I'm plain blue, said one friend of mine. That's one of the really good ones. They kicked ass. It turns out, by remarkable coincidence, that Jerry and my wife are from the same banner, bordered yellow, which is kind of like having the same astrological sign, except that there were only eight banners, so I guess it's not quite as special to say both being Libras. Anyway, bordered yellow was apparently the banner that supplied women to the imperial household in Qing times, so I am totally stoked. Compared to some of the other Chinese minorities who emphasize singing, dancing, colorful costumes, and water splashing, the Manchus are rather austere. Fan Fan was raised by her stern and dour grandmother, who schooled her in the rigid etiquette of Manchus. Chi bu yan, shui bu yu, she taught her young ward. Do not speak when eating, and do not talk while sleeping. Manchus do not eat dog meat, a friendly canine having once saved the life of the great Manchu forebearer Nurhaci. I've given up Goro, incidentally, in solidarity with my Manchu spouse. Good posture being the mainstay of the Manchu Veltanshang, Fan Fan was constantly admonished as a child to stand erect. Don't lean against a wall or in a doorway when you stand, and don't crack sunflower seeds while leaning in a doorway or you'll look like a prostitute, Grandma would warn. Posture was important while seated, too. One must never cross one's legs and never lean back in one's chair. Chair backs were strictly ornamental, and just to make sure, Manchu carpenters designed theirs for maximum ergonomic unfriendliness. Manchu women didn't bind their feet, which is why Fan Fan has to do her footwear shopping at a special store for clowns. That is, if you buy her Lamarckian evolutionary claims. Other special Manchu characteristics, alas, do not seem to have passed along genetically. Jumping onto galloping horses from one side or onto camels from the rear was the most popular recreational activity among Manchus, reads one authoritative source on minority nationalities. Pole climbing, sword play, juggling a flagpole and archery on ice, surely the inspiration for the Olympic biathlon, are the more interesting sports of the Manchu people, this authority goes on to say. Pity such arts are now lost. After the overthrow of the Qing dynasty in the revolution of 1911, the once proud bannermen, who in better times rode roughshod over the Han and, having wowed them with their flagpole juggling and excellent posture, compelled them to sport the funny hairdos known as the queue. They were reduced to a sort of second-class citizenry. They were unpopularly regarded, or they were popularly regarded as having lost their martial spirit and retained an unwarranted sense of entitlement. Bannermen were satirized and ridiculed as lazy wards of the state and as absurdly devoted to defending their declining status, wrote David Strand in his fascinating study of Beijing in the 1920s, Rickshaw Beijing. Things have, of course, changed, and nowadays many descendants of the bannermen lead useful and productive lives as birdcage guys or hutong chess kibitzers. So, here are some pointers for you when interacting with your Manchu friends. 1. When someone tells you they're Manchu, immediately ask, which banner? And irrespective of his answer, say, wow, that was one of the really good ones. 2. Emphatically agree with the assertion that Kangxi, Yongzheng, and Qianlong were the best emperors in Chinese history. 3. Be respectful about dietary restrictions, and most importantly, never make jokes about pastimes like camel jumping, which I'm told is now making a comeback among young Manchus. Well, there's that, and stay tuned after we sign off for more fun, including a song courtesy of some leading scholars of the Manchus, lyrics, I believe, by Mark Elliott, and sung and recorded with some very, very good musicianship by Jim Millward, my friend Jim Millward from Georgetown. So what the hell, it's summer, have a good time. Let's dive in and give some history first in broad brushstrokes. So, Jeremiah, who in fact were these Manchus and where did they come from?
Yeah, the Manchus, in fact, before they were even called Manchus, were a group of people who claimed descent from the Jurchen. And the Jurchen were people who, from what's now Manchuria, who had in
confusingly
the,
enough.
funnily enough, yes. In the 10th and 11th century, had formed the Jin dynasty and conquered a great deal of what's today North China. Later on, the Jin would be themselves conquered by another people from outside, from beyond the Pale, the Mongols. And in some ways kind of faded from history until the late 16th century, early 17th century, when different groups of these people who, again, you know, the links with the Jurchen, some of it's kind of mythology, some of it's actually families passed down. But in any case, some of these groups came together in a loose confederation under the leadership of a chieftain named Nurhaci and his family.
Nurhaci of the Isinguro clan, right?
Nurhaci of the Isinguro, which in some ways means
gold. Of the
gold.
Changbaishan Isinguros.
Yes. And Nurhaci and his family had kind of risen to power both through a combination of political skills, savvy marriages, but also through trade. They were key purveyors of goods from Manchuria to the Ming court and to other areas as well. Notably, they had a monopoly on the trade of ginseng. And from this, they became quite wealthy, quite powerful. And by consolidating all the different groups of, if you will, proto-Manchus together, pretty soon Nurhaci started to outline the basics of what would be kind of its own state, modeled in some cases after the Ming in terms of ministries and boards. And even though Nurhaci died, his son, Hong Taiji, picked up the mantle. It's actually Hong Taiji who bestows the name Manchu on the people.
Where does that name actually come from?
Yeah, there's a lot of debate about this. And it's one of those things where it depends really on who you ask. Some people think it comes from
Manjushri.
Buddhist terms. Other people, you know, that I think it's one of those things we really don't know, though the mythology is certainly interesting. But it was, I think, at that time a way to kind of break a little bit from the history of the Jin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that happens with the Manchus as they're growing in power in what's today Northeast China is that they start to bring in other people into their kind of nascent empire.
What year are we talking about now?
We're talking still about early 17th century.
Early 17th century. You know, one of the first people that they conquer or bring into the fold is, of course, the Mongols. Or at least groups of the Mongols that are in what's now Inner Mongolia, Eastern Mongolia. They also start to attract Han Chinese,
mm-hmm.
Some of whom actually were living in the area, were actually going over to the Manchus because this is a time when the Ming Empire itself is crumbling and there's a kind of a sense of decay, if not actual sense that the end is near. And others are Chinese and other groups that have been kind of brought into the Manchu fold, not by choice.
There was economic opportunity there, too.
And there were economic opportunities there, for sure, absolutely.
These guys made their fortune in herb, right? Specifically the root of a particular plant called ginseng.
Right.
Right. That was...
And I think, you know, it's important to kind of separate sort of the Manchus from the Mongols as well. I think there's still an idea that the Manchus are just like are like the Mongols in terms of horseback raiders from the steppes. And certainly the Manchus fought on horseback, but they're mostly from mountains, forests of northeast
China. Right. They probably got as much of their protein from fish as they did from
– Yeah, that's a really good point actually. Soon that they the Manchus, who now are starting to consider themselves their own dynasty, the Qing.
Qing means pure. Does anyone know the origins of the
– Well, you know, I think part of it was moving away from the Jin name. There's something about – and one of the things about both the character for Man in Manzhu and Qing is that both use the water radical.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is there's one theory that says that these were consciously chosen because the Ming, the character coming together with the moon and the sun, one of the operative element for the Ming was fire.
Right.
And that if using the water radicals in some ways, sort of was a way to overcome that, at least cosmologically.
Right, in the five elements theory. Right.
Exactly. And Jin, of course, which means gold, fire melts gold. Again, these are often part of a mythology of the origins of the Qing state mm-hmm. that was written and told much later. So, I mean, trying to separate out the actual history from some of the history making that the Manchus themselves did, it can be a little bit tricky. It's also about this time, too, that the Manchus forced Korea to kind of renounce its loyalty, its tributary status with the Ming, and to recognize Qing suzerainty, which was for the Ming kind of a body blow.
And what year did that happen?
I think again, it's obviously before 1644. I want to say it's around 1619, 1620.
So 1644 obviously is the big watershed year that we're leading up to here. So most of this action is happening in the decades just before that.
That's right. And to go up to the to 1644, during this time the Manchus encroach on Ming territory. There are battles between Ming armies and Manchu armies. In fact, there's one very famous battle in which the Ming are able to turn back the Manchus using cannons and other weapons that they had copied from the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
And to an extent, the Ming Empire was able to keep the Manchus at bay until 1644. In essence, they had ceded pretty much everything north of the wall. And the key pass...
Shanhaiguan.
It was Shanhaiguan, exactly. At the same time all this is going on north of the wall, as people who know their Ming history will tell you, the empire is falling apart, and you have all these different rebel leaders who are just carving a swath of devastation against large parts of the Ming Empire.
Finally, the one guy in Sichuan, Zhang Zhongchang, I think is his name.
Zhang Xianzhong.
Yeah.
And, I mean...
Li Zicheng is the one who the dashing general who actually does succeed in early June of 1644.
He takes the city. This is the famous story of...
Slow down, guys. I think we need to explain that a bit.
Sure. Okay, let's go back. So the Ming is in turmoil. There are multiple peasant-led uprisings against the Ming. The Ming is already in deep decay. I mean, it's got all the classic problems of, you know, a eunuchate run wild and whatnot. An emperor who, I mean, in, you know...
Not that the Ming were ever known for great political skill. I mean, this is a dynasty that lost an emperor for 14 years. It's an emperor. It's not a puggle.
Right.
You know, it's just like, hey, I don't know. We came back from the front and he's not here. I thought you had him. So Ming had never really been known for their dynamic political skill at the center. But by this point... quite literally, all hell had broken loose. And as Kaiser said, one of these rebel groups had grown strong enough and powerful enough that they had been able to take the city of Beijing.
Found a short-lived dynasty called the Shun, actually.
Which means loyalty, ironically enough.
Right.
And this is the moment where, for those of you who have sort of been to Beijing, there's a famous or spot, if not actually a famous tree, where the last emperor of the Ming dynasty...
Hanged himself.
Right. After hearing the bandits had taken the city and his officials had fled. So this kind of sets up an interesting scenario because one of the last of the real kind of Ming military, the last of the Ming military power at this point is an army under the control of a man named General Wu Sangui. And General Wu, being a very capable commander, is charged with holding the pass at Shanhaiguan. It's kind of the pass.
It's where the mountains meet the sea. It's where the Great Wall meets the sea.
It's where the Great Wall meets the sea. And it's also the place, really, his point of being there is essentially to keep the Manchus at bay, to guard the border between what is now kind of a rising Qing state, even if the Ming emperors don't want to acknowledge it. It certainly is growing in power, and you know the what the Ming still control. General Wu is faced with a bit of a dilemma, and you know if we can kind of get into his head, I suppose, for a moment, you know, you could see General Wu sitting there saying, you know, I don't know why I'm here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I don't know what I'm going to do. Fight Lisa Chung or the Manchus. I got bandits to the left of me. Dorgon to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with Wu. So,
thank you, Gary Rafferty. Is that what it is, Gary Rafferty?
I think it is, actually, but he was with Steeler Wheels at that time, though. That really can't be that we can skip.
Why do I know that song? Is it from
Reservoir Dogs?
Yeah, that's right. That's what it is. Right.
But in all seriousness, General Wu has a choice.
I don't think we're ever going to be forgiven this, Jeremiah.
I've been waiting for so long to do that. Every time I try to do that in class, I deal with 20-year-olds who look at me like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Sort of the way I was looking at you. Okay.
On with the story, Jeremiah.
On with the story, okay.
All right, I promise, last musical number unless Kaiser chooses to sing again. So again, General Wu has this dilemma. Does he actually try to retake the city, keep the peace, or does he stay there and defend against the Manchus? And he makes kind of a fateful decision to ask the Manchus to join him in a peacekeeping mission in the city of Beijing. The Manchus readily agree. The leader of the Manchus at this time is actually a general or a leader named Dorgon. He is the uncle of the very young emperor. Dorgon practically trips over himself agreeing to this. And General Wu sends his armies against Lisa Chung's armies in battle. After the two Chinese armies basically fight to a draw, Dorgon unleashes the Manchus on the field of battle and sweeps away Lisa Chung's army, heads to the city of Beijing, restores the peace there, but instead of bringing the Ming back to the throne or a Ming clan back to the throne, he puts his infant nephew on the throne, and they proceed to stay for the better part of the next three centuries.
That infant nephew being?
The infant nephew became the Shunzhi Emperor.
Right, the Shunzhi Emperor.
And, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, this is actually a pretty cataclysmic moment for a lot of people. There's this narrative I think you hear sometimes, and I hear it especially among kind of popular historians or tour guide types in China, is that, you know, the Qing, well, yes, they were a conquest dynasty, but they were of a different character than, say, like the Mongols or even the old Jurchen.
Right. Let me see if I can anticipate what you're going to say, because, you know, I'm sure I've repeated this, you know, dozens of times in various survey classes, that they sort of out-Confucianed the Confucian Ming, that they gave proper burial rites to the last Ming emperor, that they honored scholars, that they were these
Sinophiles,
right?
Well, they were in a way, but that I think what sometimes happens is people see that and think that's the only thing that they were.
Right.
You know.
Sure, they made you wear funky haircuts, but
Yeah, I mean that. I mean some of this. I mean some of those ways that Manchus changed things. First of all, the Manchus launched this like great, period of conquest and consolidation throughout the old Ming Empire.
Right.
There's all kinds of claimants to the Ming throne throughout the empire because the Ming would send princes to go live other places. So every time one of them would be captured or killed, another Ming claimant would suddenly rise up and say, "I'm the emperor of the Ming." And ironically, the person that the Manchus send to go play whack-a-ming is Wu Sangui, who finally chases the last Ming claimant all the way down to
Guangzhou, right?
Well, actually into Burma.
Into Burma, right. And, oh, right. Yeah, that's right.
Wu Sangui makes a deal with the king of Burma along the lines of hand him over or become the southernmost province of the new Qing Empire. And they hand him over, and he's executed. And for his loyalty, Wu Sangui is pretty much handed a huge chunk of territory in South China.
Southwest China, right. It's basically the Yungwei Plateau.
In fact, all of South China is in the hands of three former feudatories, and they become feudatories, exactly. So that it takes actually a long time for the Qing Empire to consolidate its conquest of all of the old Ming China. But that, you know, we go back to the whole Sinophile thing. I mean, what's interesting, of course, is, and what makes the Manchu Emperor so infinitely cool, is that being the son of heaven, being the Confucian ruler, they were going to out-Confucian the Confucians, but they weren't going to stop there. They were going to out-Mongol Khan Genghis.
at the same time.
Right. They were going to out, you know, they were going to out acolyte the most loyal and fervent student of Tibetan Buddhism. And these weren't false pretexts. They weren't false appearances. They weren't really trying to deceive anybody. The Manchu emperors really, they saw themselves, first of all, not just as Chinese emperors, but as the rulers of something both very old and very new. They saw their empire in the same way, and in kind of an inner Asian way.
Right, the oceanic Khan kind of idea, right?
And the idea was, the goal was to try to reunite all the different parts of inner Asia along with, you know, what is the Chinese heartland. And to do that, the Manchus, you know, one of the reasons why the Manchus succeeded, and the old story, in the early 20th century when Han Chinese historians were looking at this period and they said, well, how could a very small group of, you know, Manchus rule the great, you know, Chinese nation for so long? They came to the conclusion that what happened to the Manchus was they came in, they were so impressed and awed by the glories of Chinese civilization that they Sinicized. And that is the only way they possibly could have succeeded.
Right. That idea has its roots in the sort of Mencian idea of Chinese, you know, Wen culture ultimately winning out over the barbarian Wu.
Absolutely. That, you know, virtues. That Mencius had never heard of a civilization being barbarized, but right. You know, civilization will always tame the barbarian. And, you know, what was really interesting about this was they weren't tamed so much as able to recast themselves as universal rulers of a multi-ethnic empire. And to do so, they had to really kind of see themselves when, you know, when they were with their Han officials, they could discuss, you know, all about the Confucian texts, and they would practice their calligraphy, and they'd be great patrons of literature and art. And then when they were interacting with Mongols or the fellow Manchu princes, you know, they would wear their furs, they'd go tiger hunting. You know, it was very important to be able to shoot a bow and arrow from horseback. There was an archery range not too far away from the main throne room in the Forbidden City.
Right.
And then when other groups came in, say, for example, you know, a little bit later, groups from Tibet, you know, they would talk about their devotion to Tibetan Buddhism, and they would talk as students of Tibetan Buddhism. And, you know, this way of kind of running an empire, the way that they maintained their distinctiveness as a separate people who had clearly conquered all these areas and were ruling them, but still was able to present a face and present themselves as an acceptable kind of ruler to all these different groups.
You know,
that was remarkable.
Can I interrupt you with a question here? Because one of the interesting things about Beijing that I've realized a lot of people subject to the Chinese educational system don't realize is that it was once an apartheid city that for, as I understand it, quite long periods of the Qing dynasty, if you were a Han Chinese, if you were not Manchu, you pretty much couldn't go into central Beijing.
Yeah, you lived south of Qianmen.
Right? Yeah, basically you were in Qianmen in the part of the city
in the
south.
The whole
is this not yeah. true? And what's behind this? How does this relate to the what we've just been talking about?
Well, first of all, it's a really interesting topic because it changed the way the city looks. If you look at a map of the city, you'll see that the inner city has the orderly system of hutong and alleyways for the most part.
The rectilinear stuff, right?
Exactly. And then you look at the outer city, southern city, if you will, and you'll see how all the streets.
So let's put that on a map. That's basically south of
Qianmen.
Tiananmen Square, south of Qianmen.
All those streets rush up to a central point, which is Qianmen. And that's because not only were all the Han Chinese moved out of the inner city, a lot of the businesses, brothels, theaters, and other things were moved out, and they were all kind of clustered around that main area there. And that's when that area, which had always been kind of a thriving market area anyway, really took off as an important commercial center. Now it's that Epcot Center pedestrian walkway with Zara.
But it was, in fact, once Beijing's own Chinatown.
Yes, I mean, that's a good way of putting it.
Actually. Yeah.
And I think this comes actually from the Manchu experience even before they had invaded south of the wall, because there had been incidents in the early 17th century where Han Chinese had tried to poison wells, or at least the Manchus thought Han Chinese were trying to poison wells against them. So there was a concern about what it meant for Manchus and Han to live in close proximity to each other. And the other, Kaiser alluded to this too, the other big change that was made or instituted was, of course, the rule about hair.
Right.
And this was the famous Q, the shaving of the front head, the front of the forehead, and then the braiding of the long hair in the back in a long braid. And of course, you know, ironically, for a lot of Americans, this is a very typical Chinese hairstyle. And the old, quasi-racist children's books that I still remember when I was a kid. You know, if it was a Chinese character, they had the Q.
Well, sure, because they were drawn from the Qing Dynasty.
They were drawn from the Qing Dynasty.
Of course, people in solidarity with the Sun Yat-sen and the revolution beginning in the latter part of the first decade of the 20th century, they took scissors and they actually would snip off their ponytails, beginning a tradition of Q cutting that has remained with us since.
And it even starts earlier than that. I mean, in the late 18th century, the Qianlong Emperor became fascinated with this case of people who were stealing cues in parts of China.
Right.
And it wasn't just that these cues were being used for sorcery. It wasn't just the fact that local officials weren't really doing their job. It was, why are they cutting off the cues? And the cue became kind of a fixation for the Manchus, really, in terms of tests of loyalty. And at the time when they came in, there was actually an expression. It was something like
Yep. Keep your cue or lose your head.
Keep your hair, lose your head, right. Lose your hair, keep your head.
It's the kind of motto Kaiser would approve of.
Yeah. Bang the head that doesn't bang.
Yeah. So, I mean, Jeremy, you're right in the sense that there was a lot of changes. And I think one of the cool things, too, is that so much of what we think of as sort of Lao Beijing Wenhua, like old Beijing culture, right? A lot of it comes from the Manchus. I mean, yes, to be let's kind of put one thing on the table too.
Can we just like blame Douzhi on them? And
well, I mean, we were talking about cynicization, and there's what's happened in academia in the last 20 years has been something called the New Qing History, which started
let's get into that. This is very interesting.
This started with. It started with several scholars who had been looking at the Qing Empire and were kind of wondering, well, how did it look from the perspective of the Manchus? And one of the kind of ironic things about the study of the Qing had been kind of a priority even during much of the PRC period. But ironically, a lot of the Manchu language documents had lingered ignored in the archives. And there's something like 10 million documents in Manchu. Later on, beginning in the late 80s and early 1990s, scholars both from abroad and from China, started to look at these documents and read the Manchu, and they realized that, wow, a lot of our assumptions about, for example, sinicization and assimilation look very different when we see it from the Manchu perspective. And one of the ways...
In other words, they were writing stuff in Manchu that they weren't writing in Chinese.
Absolutely.
They were communicating about things that never made it into the Chinese language,
and
right?
And in fact, even later on, and yes...
When we say later on, how late do you think that...
The timeline of this is kind of interesting, and this kind of gets in a little bit to what I was writing about.
Let's kind of go emperor by emperor. Okay, so Kangxi... Very Manchu still, right?
Yeah, it kind of gets into what I was talking about in the Economist article. Kangxi was still very Manchu. He preferred speaking in Manchu. When he met the Jesuits, for example, who were at court, these were missionaries who had come from Europe, who were there as astronomers. But actually, Kangxi preferred not speaking to them in Chinese, even though the Jesuits had pretty good Chinese. He preferred speaking to them in Manchu. In Kangxi's court, there was a lot of complaints that, the Chinese officials and the Manchu officials weren't able to communicate with each other because the Chinese didn't speak Manchu. Manchus did not speak Chinese. His son, who Isinzhuo Yinzhen, or the Yongzheng Emperor, spoke Chinese pretty well. Kangxi was certainly...
Let's not forget that he reigned for 60 years.
He had some very good tutors, and he was certainly functional in Chinese. It's just that he preferred Manchu. Yongzheng's kind of the transition. He kind of went back and forth, though he was still famous for yelling at Manchu's guard. For example, Yongzheng's the one who starts yelling at his Manchu guards for speaking Chinese.
Okay.
He wants them to speak Manchu. Probably, and this kind of has some bearing on various popular TV shows at the moment, probably when he was at home with his family, especially if he's talking to people or members of his family or members of I was going to use the word harem, but wow, how Orientalist is that?
Isn't that an accurate description?
I would say it's just the palace women, especially those who are...
That's harem, right?
Well, that's a Turkish... It's an Ottoman idea. It's a different...
When speaking with his wives and children, he would probably have been more comfortable speaking to them in Manchu.
There we go.
By the time you get to... This is not the
early 18th what he should have known is if you want to raise bilingual children, you have, one concubine only speak to them in Manchu.
Secrets from the crypt, kind of.
His son was certainly bilingual, but it's Qianlong who ruled from 1736 to 1796 plus 3 years for shits and giggles. that really that's where things start to change. It's Qianlong who starts, for example, worrying about the fact that Manchus aren't speaking Manchu anymore. It's right. a security issue in the army. And he's also the one who starts compiling some of the grand histories of the Manchu people. Mm-hmm. We're talking about kind of the mythology of where the Manchus came
from. So if we can I ask at Qianlong at this point, how hard is the Manchu apartheid? In other words, as they, if Qianlong is basically the point at which Manchus are worrying about them becoming Chinese, are they still enforcing apartheid?
They're not worried about them becoming Chinese at all. They're worried about them speaking Chinese.
They're worried.
So there's still no intermarriage. There's still...
Yeah, and then there's the system of Manchus living in the inner city and Chinese not living, Chinese living in the outer city.
That remains in place.
That, right until 1912.
Right.
There is some weakening of it towards the end, but not very much. And even in the other garrison cities, they would have banner troops, banner garrisons, and the banners are groups of groups
hereditary
of
military.
And this is what Kaiser was talking about in his essay.
That wasn't an essay.
An essay means literally an attempt, Kaiser, uh-huh. So it's fine.
But yeah, they, when they were in garrison cities, they would also kind of live apart as well. And this kind of sense of distinction, this sense of difference, this sense of separateness persisted. Even though, I mean, the Manchus by the 19th century are pretty much speaking Chinese, and there's some idea that I've heard that Puyi, the very last emperor, could say one word in Manchu, and it was the word for arise. You know, language is part of it, but still the idea, the sense that the Manchus were a people apart, this persisted down really until 1912, and even to a certain extent after, though one of the things that happens in the revolution of 1911, which we sometimes think as being kind of a bloodless revolution, Sun Yat-sen and all that, is that a lot of groups of Manchus, particularly these garrisons that were in different parts of the empire.
They're slaughtered wholesale.
Yeah, they're slaughtered wholesale. And so a lot of Manchus who were living outside of Beijing, and even some were living inside Beijing, started to adopt, if possible, more Chinese characteristics to kind of blend in a bit. You know, that said, it's really kind of remarkable because here's a group of people who ruled a country, for the better part of three centuries. During the revolution, they're slaughtered, in some cases wholesale. But within a few years after the revolution, they start getting included in some sort of new conceptualization of what it means to be Chinese.
Well, I mean, that which is an interesting idea because the idea persists of a sort of universal empire, of a multi-ethnic China. Right?
Yeah, and you know the recasting of what it meant to be Chinese from Hanzu or Hanren to Zhonghua Minzu, a term that could include Manchus and Han, as well as other major groups, and you know the fact
groups that had been brought into the political fold largely during the conquests of the 18th century.
Yeah, and this is where this is also where when we discuss the Qing Empire, we discuss the Manchus, and we discuss kind of reevaluating them. This is why it can be a very sensitive subject, even though we're kind of talking about things that happened 200 or 300 years ago. Because for better or for ill, the modern Chinese state has many of its foundations in the Qing Empire, not the least of which is its territory. And when you start to destabilize the link or decouple the link between what Qing and China, it makes people uncomfortable. And when I don't think that's what the new Qing history is trying to do. First of all, it's not a Western versus Chinese scholar thing. Many scholars in China who study the Qing also agree this idea of like the Manchus being Sinicized is far too simplistic,
mm-hmm.
and are coming around more to a much more complex notion of the Qing as inner Asian rulers ruling a vast empire of which Ming China is one, albeit extremely important part.
Right.
But anytime you start to start to mess with the historical narrative, it can make people uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, I think that they were especially uncomfortable, or they are especially uncomfortable, because of the way the historiography was handled by the Japanese.
That's a really important point. I mean, I think that's a really good thing to bring up, because, of course, the Japanese really
tried to de-link. Right.
Yeah, they create a Manchu homeland in Manchuria called Manchukuo, and they even dig Puyi out of mothballs and bring him, his wives, and his boyfriends, up to Manchukuo to become an emperor of the Manchu people.
Did Peter O'Toole get to go too, or was he?
I don't think he was around by then. Reginald Johnston was still around by then. Right. But, one of the things to say too is when we're talking about that the Sinicization narrative is too simplistic and, the Manchus didn't become assimilated, we don't want to go too far and say that, oh, you know, that not, they did, nothing changed. They certainly became what Qing historian and kind of the dean of Manchu history, if you will, in the U.S., Mark Elliott has called acculturated.
Right.
Which means they adopted many cultural traits that they from the Chinese and also from other parts of their empire. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they lost their identity or lost their distinctiveness.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I mean, we talk all the time about Sinicization, but the Manchus left a major imprint, especially on the city of Beijing and the environs. I mean, there's lots of things today that we think of as quintessentially Chinese that are in fact Manchu. Let's start with the qi pao. I mean, what's the qi in qi pao? The qi in qi pao is the, I mean, it means banner gowns, oh. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you're talking about the qi. The
qiangsam, the women's form-fitting dress that buttons with a high sort of what they call a mandarin collar at the on the side. The side buttoning thing.
Right, and the Q is kind of the stereotypical Chinese symbol for men in the early, like in the 20th century in the West. The qi pao was kind of the stereotypical fashion for women, Chinese women. Except,
right.
Again, both were derived from Manchu culture more so than Han Chinese culture.
Qi paos are nice anyway. I mean, I can't see myself sporting a queue, but a qi pao on my wife is a fair thing to behold.
That's good, because all of a sudden I had visions of you in a queue and a qi pao, and it wasn't a
good... I don't think we should go there, Jeremiah. That doesn't sound good.
What else? I mean, I think there's a huge imprint on Beijing Hua, on the Chinese language. In fact, I mean, I had one professor describe standard Mandarin, Beijing Mandarin, is essentially courtly Mandarin spoken with an atrocious Manchu accent. Is there any truth to that?
You know, I've heard the exact same thing, and I think that there's a lot of northern, or I should say...
a lot of southerners who would say the same, right?
Right, and I think there's a lot of influence on northern Chinese dialects that come from, if you will, beyond the wall, Manchus among them.
The Arhuayin apparently is. What did Manchu sound like? Maybe we can cue up a tape here and listen to it, a little bit of what a Manchu dialogue would have sounded like. What does that remind you of, any languages that you've heard before?
Other than Romulan. You know, I mean, it's...
You're such a nerd.
Yeah, yes. I'm sitting here on a podcast talking about Manchu linguistics. What tipped you off? Yeah, I mean, Manchu itself is obviously a very different, and spoken Manchu is obviously a very different language than Chinese, and even the written language was a script that was created around the time of Nur Hachi and his son. It was based itself
on Mongol, right?
It's based on Mongol, which itself was based on scripts from what's now Xinjiang, Turkic scripts,
mm-hmm.
And so it has it traces its roots actually well across the Silk Road.
Okay. But I mean, the spoken language, more importantly, that sounds an awful lot like sort of what, Korean a bit.
I think to some extent, though, it's
I think linguistically it is related to Korean, is it not?
I believe so.
Okay, I mean, that would make sense. They came from the Changbaishan.
I'm thinking more about the Manchus. I don't have as much. I don't know as much about Korea, but. You know, the idea that this language was very different was important. And I mentioned before that it was kind of a security issue. That in the army, for example, you know, the idea that Manchu should speak Manchu because this was a way to kind of keep, you know, to be able to do commands that people couldn't understand. Right. And Jeremy mentioned the written language, the documents that for a long time people thought that there was just, the Manchus were just translating whatever the Chinese told them to. And in fact, the documents were very different. They were essentially writing in code about what was going on. And... You know, while that does...
So the Nabu stuff.
Yeah, though that again, even that, to some extent, by the time you get to the 19th century, sort of the last 100 years of Manchu rule in China in China and around the empire, you start to see Manchu documents become more sort of perfunctory or ceremonial.
Do you know if anyone has done any research? I mean, it seems like a fairly simple thing to do, to just do a core sample of courtly documents and see... across time, the proportion of them produced in Manchu, in Chinese, and in both, and see the changing proportion across time.
I think well, when we do our recommendations, I'd like to. There's two books I'd like to recommend for people who are interested in reading more about
the Manchus.
Both of those books kind of do something along those lines.
Look, enough of all this nonsense. What I want to know, Jeremiah, what about the stories of women performing fellatio on their infant sons?
You've not heard of this?
I'm not sure if it was Hudson, one of our interns, found a reference to Manchu mothers performing fellatio on their sons.
This is quite well known.
What the hell are your interns Googling
when they're working to get this kind of stuff?
I wrote to Michael Meyer, actually. We were corresponding, and he forbid me to quote from our email exchange, but I'm going to quote from him anyway. And he's working on a book, obviously, about living in Manchuria. So I asked him about the story of women performing fellatio on their young sons, and he said, I've been visiting a Manchu-speaking village, a day's train from the Japanese-speaking one. Just gorgeous up there. I can see why Qianlong lamented the loss of their invented homeland. Plus, their moms blow them. What's not to like? Anyway, sorry, Mike. I couldn't resist. But so, Jeremiah, you can't explain this.
Well, I mean,
because Michael refused to.
There's a lot of stories like that out of the Manchus. I was talking with a local historian, Eric Abramson, who did a series of walking tours of Beijing. And one of the things that he was telling me was near Wangfujing, when he was doing his research, this was right around the time of the Olympics, and they had just ripped down what was called the Naigong, or literally Milk Palace.
The Tit Palace.
But which I thought should be called the Lactorium. And this was where apparently young Manchu maidens were milked for the Empress Dowager's table. I thought the funniest thing was, of course, it was like three or four doors down from the Imperial Chop Shop where the eunuchs were produced. So I don't know what was going on in that street. I bet there was a lot of fascinating conversations right around that block, people walking in, people walking. What are you in for? I'm being milked. What are you in for? You don't want to know. Yeah. If it was one of those take a number situations and things got mixed up, I could imagine that would be a problem.
No wonder Edmund Backhouse wrote some of the things he did. I'm starting to understand.
Indeed.
Let's just say this. One of the things about Manchus in general is that a lot that was written about, especially towards the end of the dynasty, at the end of the empire, there was a lot of crazy stories that came out. And part of it was the demonization of the Manchus as being blamed for a lot of the problems that had beset China toward, you know, in the 19th century.
Sure.
The Manchus cared only about saving themselves, not saving China. When ethnic nationalism, kind of Western notions of ethnic nationalism, are introduced into China, they tend to dovetail very nicely with kind of, at that time, recently discovered anti-Manchu writings from the early 17th century. And they inspire some of the early revolutionaries, people like Zhang Binglin and Zhou Rong and even Sun Yat-sen. And so that's, you know, I mentioned before, it's kind of interesting that after the revolution, the Manchus are kind of invited back in the fold because for the last 20 years of their empire, these revolutionaries writing really vicious and vile things about them. And today, if I'm not mistaken, the Manchus are the third largest ethnic group in China.
So how are they faring these days? I mean, how many Manchu speakers are there today by your best estimate?
Yeah, by the best estimate. There's been a lot of stories about this in the Western press. People seem very fascinated by this. There's a handful of octogenarians who live in Manchuria who still speak Manchu.
There are a few autonomous counties.
There are many autonomous counties, but a lot of these places, Manchu is not widely spoken, at least as a native language. There's attempts by groups in Manchuria and even in Beijing to try to save the language and teach children about it, but it's very much kind of a rearguard action. There's also a group in Xinjiang that speaks what people feel is a dialect of Manchu, and the idea is that they were descended from a garrison or a group that had been sent out there and for various reasons had kind of preserved that particular linguistic heritage.
Like the Pennsylvania Dutch.
Well, to some extent, yeah. And I will say one thing, too. There's a lot of, in the Chinese universities and Chinese graduate schools, people who are studying the Qing Empire now, and the same thing is true in the U.S. If you're going to go to graduate school and study the Qing Empire because you just hate money or possibly your parents, then one of the things you're going to have to do now is learn Manchu. you think of, and it's amazing it took so long, because if you think about it, here's an empire that was ruled by a particular people, but we don't really need to learn their language.
Right. I mean, it's like I'm going to study the Ottoman Empire and not learn Turkish.
The one thing I just want to kind of, if we're kind of wrapping up a little bit, to say is,
and we are,
one other reason why it's so dicey to talk about the Qing and modern China is, you know, the transition from going from the Qing Empire to the Chinese modern state. And I'm not even talking about the PRC, because certainly in the early 20th century, state builders like the nationalists, the Kuomintang, were kind of doing the same thing. But the Qing ruled a wide, multi-ethnic empire, and they tended to rule it in a way that they demanded respect. Pay your taxes, don't revolt, and we're going to be cool. And when that, and that's to say that they ruled with a light hand, because parts of China, many parts of their empire were consolidated through conquest. I apologize, 50 centers, but it's true. You know, sending in armies to Xinjiang, to Tibet, and sending an armada across the straits to Taiwan. They also attempted to do similar things in Nepal and Vietnam with somewhat less success. But more, for the most part, though, the Qing just demanded, the Manchus just demanded respect. The problem, of course, is when you go from an empire that demands respect to a nation state, is that nation states need more than respect.
The actual, yeah, you got forces on the border, right?
Empires want to respect. Nation states want to be loved.
Right.
And that's a lot to ask people. Your identity has to be with the nation state. That's something the Manchus never asked of their people. And if you look at the places where there's the most restive populations, it's not, I mean, it's...
You don't need to pussyfoot around. I mean, just go ahead.
Right. I mean, if you look at the place with most restive populations, these are the places that were cobbled together under the Qing Empire, along with Ming China, and it was a territorial legacy that's been bequeathed to modern Republican Chinese state.
Right.
Now, I don't want this to sound like, okay, if we study the Qing, we study the Manchus, and the Manchus were an empire, therefore all territorial claims of the modern Chinese state are bogus. That is not what I'm saying at all, especially because I have to apply for a visa soon. But what it does mean is that we just kind of destabilize that notion, and we have to kind of think about how the empire was put together and how the empire became
the country. If for another reason, it helps us, it sheds some light on some of the problematic today. That exists today. I mean, I think you raise a very interesting point here. That, I mean, when you go from an empire simply demanding respect, you know, it exercises essentially only suzerainty to a truly sovereign modern national state. It is a very different game.
And not even look around China, look around the world.
Sure.
I mean, the places they're having the most problems. This is what happened. An empire fell, crumbled. Nation states emerged that asked different things of their citizens.
Let's talk very quickly about how they are faring today. In modern popular culture, there's been this new sort of craze. I mean, it started years ago. I mean, there have always been Qing costume dramas, but the interest in Qing is at a fever pitch right now.
It just there's several popular shows right now that are set in the Qing dynasty, particularly the era of the Yongzheng Emperor. So, kind of late 17th, early 18th century. Well, the Yongzheng is actually kind of late early 18th century, but Kangxi Yongzheng, and you know, what's interesting about them, and I think I got the impression that some people kind of misinterpreted what I was doing in the Economist essay. You know, I don't think that Chinese TV shows about Manchus need to have them go like the full Mel Gibson. It has to be done all in like faithfully reproduced Manchu.
I mean,
as I said in the Economist piece, I mean, Julius Caesar has like exactly three lines of Latin in the whole thing.
Right. But he, you know, as long as the Romans speak with
British
accents.
Could you imagine Deadwood without the historically anachronistic cursing? I mean, that makes the show. But what I would say is what I was surprised about was talking about this with several groups of people over the last couple of weeks was a surprise that people have when I happen to mention that, yeah, well, you know, the Manchus probably would have been speaking Manchu. Not that they should on the TV show, but in real life they probably would be. And what was shocking to me was everyone's like, really? Well, why would they do that? And it was surprising to me because I thought kind of everyone knew that. And it made me start thinking about, well, what are the Manchus like in popular consciousness? And then And it does seem to be still this idea, cynicization, that the Manchus came in and adopted Chinese ways and became successful, that historians...
Well, I mean, it's a political expedient today, too. I mean, it's...
Yeah, and it's the same reason why it felt good in the early 20th century to say that, because nobody really wants to hear that they were conquered. They'd like to hear the fact that people came in and we made them us.
politically correct. You can't refer to them in modern PRC political parlance as a conquest dynasty, right?
Yeah. So what do we say? Something separate from like the Yuan or the Liao, because if you look at the museums, if you look at the textbooks, there are people from Northeast China,
right, who had their turn at the helm.
And that's true, except that the part of Northeast China they came from was not really part of the Ming Empire.
Right.
And, you know, the thing about the Manchus too, I mean, yes, they were a conquest dynasty, but hell, they were a successful one.
Let's make some recommendations here and wrap up.
Absolutely.
Jeremiah, would you like to go first?
Yeah, I mean, for those people who are interested in Manchu history and they want to learn more about this, make sure you read Mark Elliott, The Manchu Way. Mark Elliott is one of the first American scholars to learn Manchu. He's kind of seen as one of the founders of this New Qing history. And it's a magnificent, magnificent work of scholarship, and I highly recommend it.
He's also, by the way, the lyricist of the song that you'll hear after we conclude here tonight, which is to the tune of The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald by good old Gordon Lightfoot, the Canadian balladeer. I hope you enjoy that. Jeremy, what's your recommendation?
I actually was going to recommend the same book, but since Jeremiah just stole that from me, I think just recommend Michael Meyer's new book. I haven't read it yet, although I've read a few excerpts. So In Manchuria, Life on a Rice Farm in China's Northeast. And just finally, two quick notes that are not recommendations, but are because they're too self-interested, but are notes. Note number one, Danway Model Workers List, a list of the best blogs and websites on China. We're updating it for some things that we missed out by stupidity or ignorance or other reasons. And we're going to add to that next week and make a finalized list. So send us suggestions if you have them. And the other thing is that I think Kaiser was a little too modest to mention it, but this American Life radio show and podcast that featured Kaiser, quite a bit of Seneca, and also me, is live, I think, for another week. You can download it, and then after that, they take it off. So.
Yeah, but it'll be available still. I mean, you can get it off iTunes.
Yeah, it's the internet.
I mean, it's always going to be free. My recommendation for the week is something that I may have included a couple of years ago when we did our book roundup, but it's Emperor of China, an autobiography of Kangxi.
I totally second.
Which is written by the Yale scholar Jonathan Spence. It's a really difficult conceit for him to have pulled off. It's a first-person narrative told in the person of the Kangxi Emperor. And it's really quite beautifully written, and I think it really does take you inside there. And I mean, he may not rank among the new Qing scholars, but he certainly does capture the way that the Kangxi Emperor straddles the two worlds of the Chinese courts and his own very active horse riding and arrow shooting kind of outdoorsy persona.
One more Star Trek reference. The fact that Kangxi had an arch enemy named Galdon, leader of Zongaria. Come on.
I think they were all playing Dungeons and Dragons. But anyway, thank you very much for listening, and we will see you not next week. I'm going to be off in Europe. Hopefully Jeremy will take the helm next week, but soon enough on the Seneca podcast. Thanks, Jeremiah.
Thank you, Kaiser.
Thanks, Jeremy. And enjoy this song from Mark Elliott and Jim Millward. Take care. Bye.
Churchin on down of the clan they called Aishin Gyoro. Though forgotten today, they once swaggered and swayed over China in old days of Yoro. The clan it arose from a lake mid the snows of the mountains that some call the Changba. 'Twas there that the maid ate the fruit that was laid top her clothes by the heaven-sent magpie. Fekulen was the name of the daughter who came to cavort in the pool of Bulhuri. The son she conceived by that fruit, it's believed, was then christened as Yongshan Bulhuri. Precocious lad, he talking ere he was wee, young Bukhuri received his instruction. You were born, he was told, to be prince, to wear gold. Now go out, seek your fate, and good luck, son. In a boat he set forth, drifting west, drifting north, till he came to the land of the Manju. At the time you may say this name's not yet in play. You are right, but forgive me this, can't you? At Odoli's small ford there they found the young lord on a stool made of bent branch of willow. He explained why he'd come, that their fighting was done, and they knew he was no common fellow. So respecting his word, never thought it absurd, home they bore him, their arms interlinking. Gave a princess as bride, then with one voice they cried, Bukhuri Yongshan of Manchus, you're now king. Year followed on year, Aishin Gyoros, we hear, took some liberties, fell out of favor. A rebellion arose, till clan met with great woes, all were murdered, Fancha sole survivor. His foes to elude, he posed still as a rood, with a Saksaha perched right atop him. Why, that must be a tree, said the soldier, then he turned around, Fancha fled, no one stopped him. Having left the Changbai, generations went by at the settlement at Hetuala. On the Suksuhu's banks, the clan rebuilt its ranks, made the Gyoros a powerful Khala. As the right Genjo Wei, loyal subjects were they of the Ming court, a small tributary. Six princes took charge, whose fame spread very large, the Jurchen Bela Ningu Teri. The fourth of this crew, Gyo Changa Satu, federate the clans, gain greater power. Takshi at his side, with the Ming they allied, fought the enemy, made rivals cower. But the day came along when things somehow went wrong, son and father alike killed in action. Bad fortune, said some, Genjo now is undone, others reason the Ming satisfaction. Their deaths left a void which was filled by a boy, Takshi's son by the name of Nurhati. Scarcely appeared from his uncles, he cleared off, yet all knew he'd be one to watch he. 1594 was the year that he swore that he'd swallow the tribe of the Khada. By 1606 he had found the right mix, horses, men, he had a whole lot of. 'Twas in the next year that the prince and Gadir of the Khalkha arrived to pay tribute. Sora Bela, he quoth, Jurchens, Mongols do both, bow before you your wisdom to salute. 10 years down the line and Nurhaci looks fine, heaven smiling on his bold adventure. The time was at hand his own due to demand, on the Ming he would pass a harsh censure. First declaring his state to be based on the 8-banner order, he gave it a new name. Since all Jurchens are kin, will be known as the Jin, and the mandate of Aguda I'll claim. The next step he took was to throw the whole book at the Chinese for their crimes against him. On these 7 counts I your king do denounce, get this man, cried Wan Li, go arrest him. The showdown with Ming came in 1619 at the great battle fought close to Sarfu. When the Jurchens emerged, the victors a dirge played the humble generals on their arhu. Their foes in retreat, the Jin now moved their seat to Shenyang, then an ancient walled city. They named it Mukden, and when people looked in, they saw signs of increased civility. When old Nurhaci died, the Jurchen, they cried, who will step forward now as our leader? At council they sat through the names in a hat, about to pick one who was a good reader. Nurhaci's eighth son, Hong Taiji, was the one whom the Kurultai placed all his trust in. Follow me, he declared, there's no cause to be scared. Through the great wall we shall soon be busting. Before that came true, he had much, much to do. Quip the Isho, the Chahar, their wetter. Governments to be built, Buddha halls to be gilt, cannon founded, the bigger the better. In 1635, had you then been alive, you'd have seen clever packaging changing. Jurchens are no more, we were Manchus before, so it's said, though the truth of this ranges. The legend lives on from the Jurchen on down, of the clan they called Aishin Gyoro. Though forgotten today, they once swaggered and swayed over China in old days of yore.